Hey, it's Cameron, host of FP's weekly economics podcast, Ones and Twos. Are you intrigued by how technology like artificial intelligence and cloud computing are affecting geopolitics? Do you care about how governments are using these tools? If so, then I'd recommend checking out Microsoft's Public Sector Future podcast. Head over to aka.ms/public-sector-future to find all the episodes, or just search for Public Sector Future wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Ravi Agrawal, Foreign Policy's Editor-in-Chief. This is FP Live. Welcome to the show. Russia is mourning the loss of at least 139 people after the deadliest act of terrorism on its soil in years. On Friday, March 22nd, gunmen entered a suburban concert hall in Moscow shortly before a sold-out rock concert was about to start and opened fire. The terrorist group ISIS has claimed responsibility for the attack. U.S. intelligence says the attackers were likely from an ISIS offshoot, the Islamic State of Khorasan, which has been active in Afghanistan. As it happens, the United States warned that precisely such an attack was a possibility and shared that intelligence with Russia. Moscow, likely trying to deflect what is a massive intelligence failure, is instead suggesting that Ukraine might have played a role. All of this raises several questions. Why Russia? Why now? What does it mean for terrorism more globally? And what is the state of counterterrorism capabilities in the United States and elsewhere? Well, my guest this week says it is wrong to suggest groups such as ISIS have reemerged. It would be more accurate to say they never really went away. Colin Clark is a senior research fellow at the Soufan Center and a regular contributor to Foreign Policy. He's the author of After the Caliphate, The Islamic State and the Future Terrorist Diaspora. Clark makes the case that while America still has the best intelligence system in the world, it is in decline because Washington is more focused on competition with China. And that, he says, could come back to bite the United States. This one's a bracing conversation, but an important one. We're releasing it earlier in the week because it's timely. Remember, if you like this podcast, you can also try us on video, live, on foreignpolicy.com. Subscribers get to ask questions too. Use the code FPLIVE for a discount. That is FPLIVE, one word. Let's dive in. Colin, welcome to FP Live.
Thanks so much for having me.
So let me start with the very basic question of, you know, if this is ISIS, why do they care about Russia?
Good question. I've been getting that question a lot. And as I wrote in Foreign Policy last May, along with two co-authors, Lucas Weber and Ricardo Valle, there's a lot of reasons why ISIS would target Russia. And they lay out those reasons pretty regularly in their own propaganda. ISIS perceives Russia as the vanguard of Shia Islam at this point, with the Russians, you know, propping up the Assad regime in Syria, working closely with Iran, which itself was attacked by ISIS-K in early January, also working, you know, on the ground in Syria with Hezbollah, where Wagner fighters and Hezbollah operatives are kind of working hand in glove. The Russians have also been accused of spilling a lot of Muslim blood, going all the way back to the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, 1979 to 1989, and then the brutal wars in the North Caucasus, particularly in Chechnya, but also in Dagestan, where a very heavy Russian hand waged a pretty scorched earth counterinsurgency campaign against Sunni militants there. And so there is a long track record of Russian involvement. And if you think about kind of ISIS's, and especially ISIS-K's hit list of who they hate the most, Shia are actually above even the United States, Israel, and other kind of so-called apostate regimes. And so the fact that the Russians are seen to be aiding Shia countries and groups is very problematic for ISIS-K in particular, which has a highly sectarian agenda.
Mm. You know, when it comes to radical Islamic terror, we often see the so-called West as, you know, what is projected as the immediate enemy. So countries like the United States, the UK, France, and so on. And we're all familiar with the saying, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And I'm curious why that doesn't apply here. I'm deliberately making this black and white, Colin, and I'd like you to add in the shades of gray, but the theory would just be that Russia's invasion of Ukraine has made it the clear enemy of the West, and Russia's found common cause with other actors who see their interests as diverging from that of the West. But clearly, when it comes to terrorism, it looks like it's different. So ISIS can be anti-West and anti-Russia. Explain that to us.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I spoke at length Yaroslav Trofimov of the Wall Street Journal the other day about a piece he was working on that kind of looked at exactly this. And, you know, in the West, we're pretty obsessed with this concept of great power competition or strategic competition, right? The United States, Russia, China, kind of that second level, countries like Turkey, Iran, and others. ISIS-K doesn't discriminate. They hate all of these regimes or all of these countries for different reasons, frankly, and, you know, has attacked Iran, has launched an attack in Turkey this year against the Catholic Church, has now attacked Russia, and certainly would like to attack the United States. There's been numerous plots broken up in Europe already just this year alone, plots in Germany, another plot targeting Sweden. So the Islamic State doesn't really differentiate between the types of regimes. It also focuses quite a bit on China. One of the few actors to criticize Chinese repression of Uyghurs in Xinjiang, right? You don't even see that from Muslim countries in the Gulf who are very, willing to criticize the United States, Israel, and others, but very rarely, if ever, rebuke the Chinese for their treatment. ISIS-K sees themselves as a vanguard in that regard. And so, looks across the globe and has different reasons for hating all of these different countries, but doesn't discriminate. And you're right, it's one of those actors that really kind of doesn't adhere to that maxim.
Mm. And guilty as charged in terms of focusing on geopolitics. Tell us a bit more about ISIS-K. So I want to come to ISIS more broadly in a bit, but the K stands for Khorasan. What is this group? What do they want?
Yeah, so this is Islamic State. If you think about what ISIS is today, this is a global network of affiliates, franchises, and it's spread throughout the world, right? From North Africa to Southeast Asia and really everywhere in between. In my book, After the Caliphate, which is now, 5 years old, it came out shortly after the collapse of the physical caliphate in March 2019, when Baghouz, the last piece of territory, was taken away. I was really trying to think about what comes next, right? And the thesis happens to be in the subtitle, the future terrorist diaspora. And that's really what we're seeing now. We see this group and its followers forming a global network. But the Afghan affiliate, I wrote about at length, because at the time I thought, and I still do, and, last week's events only further solidify this, that this was the most operationally capable of all the ISIS franchise groups. I compared it at the time to AQAP or Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, Al-Qaeda's group based in Yemen, that, as you remember, in the mid 2000s to 2010s, really was quite chippy, right? You had the underwear bomber plot, you had another aviation related plot with a cargo plane, and they were really kind of taking big shots. Luckily for us, many of these plots were disrupted or there was a certain level of ineptitude, but they were swinging for the fences. And that's where I see ISK today, right? It's that really kind of nefarious marriage of intent and capability. And when you're looking at a group like that, particularly in a country like Afghanistan, where the only bulwarks, preventing ISIS-K from expanding is the Taliban, right? So the Taliban, really effective insurgents, not quite effective counterinsurgents. It's a different skill set. Without kind of eyes and ears there, it's really an intelligence blind spot. And I think that's why you're seeing this steady drumbeat of plots. I'd also just mention briefly, French President Emmanuel Macron mentioned for the first time yesterday, the first time that I remember hearing in a public forum, that ISIS-K plots have been disrupted in France as well. So you can add that data point to the list. I think a lot of eyes will be looking at the Paris 2024 Summer Olympics as a really attractive target for terrorists.
Oh, gosh. Who do they target for recruitment? And I'm curious how this plays into, you know, Afghanistan post the Taliban takeover. Has that then created the conditions for them to flourish in a way that they weren't 7 or 8 years ago?
It certainly seems that they have more operational space, you know, even with the Taliban attempting to take the fight to ISK. And, you know, Amira Jadun was one of the leading scholars, wrote a book with Andrew Mines on this, and really kind of mapped out a lot of the evolution of what we've seen today. And again, this is a group that pulls from a broader regional network, Tajiks, Uzbeks, Central Asians, all the way up into the Caucasus. I think people are looking for kind of, you know, as we do the forensics on this attack, were these card-carrying ISIS-K members? And with ISIS, it's not necessarily that simple, and it doesn't have to be. They can pull logistical and facilitation networks, you know, that span, you know, Central Asia, that reach into parts of South Asia, all the way up into the North Caucasus, and even into Russia. So this is, you know, I'd say truly it's a regional threat. It's becoming a global one. And without an effective counterinsurgent force in the country, this is one that's likely going to expand. In fact, you know, the Taliban's kind of draconian approach has actually benefited ISK because it's pushed recruits to join the group, right? And the Taliban's been with a stretch too. It's now in charge, not just of counterterrorism, but running a country, and doing so, you know, it's not recognized formally in the international community. So Taliban's having diplomatic meetings with the Chinese, with the Russians. At the same time, it's tasked with this very, very difficult objective of stamping out a vibrant ISK insurgency, which also, you know, has links across the border into Pakistan.
And I'm still curious how this group defines its interests. What does it want? So, you know, I think with Al-Qaeda 10, 15 years ago, we often had the sense that there was an easily explainable set of interests, you know, America's downfall, for example, that seemed to be telegraphed and seemed to be a recruiting tool of sorts. You see this also with the so-called axis of resistance across the Middle East, which is Iran-backed and includes a range of groups. What is ISIS-K's sort of recruiting propaganda kind of umbrella? You know, what does it want?
I think ultimately, like any Islamic State affiliate or franchise group, it wants to reestablish a caliphate, right? And so, you know, we see parts of the Sahel in Africa really kind of growing a bigger footprint there. ISIS core in Iraq and Syria is hurting, right? And so that's the other thing to be aware of, is these groups have been flow and power, right? And so groups in Libya and the Philippines, you know, are somewhat dormant right now. I'd add Yemen to that list, and IS footprint in Somalia is pretty small, although that group in particular plays an important logistical role, especially in moving money around between the Middle East and South Asia. But this group, I'd say, you know, big picture, wants to reestablish the caliphate. In the meantime, they want to wreak havoc. They want to bring us back to a place where we were in 2015 and 2016, at what I would call the kind of apex of the Islamic State writ large, where it seemed like almost every week there was another attack, right? You had major attacks, spectacular attacks like the Bataclan in France in November 2015, the Brussels attack in March 2016. But then you also had this string of high-profile vehicle attacks. You had Nice, Berlin, Stockholm, New York City, and others, that ISIS also developed this multi-tiered approach to launching attacks, right? Very sophisticated, because it could do, it could conduct attacks in different ways. It had inspired attacks, right? The kind of lowest level, where their propaganda was pushing extremists who were radicalized to take action on their own. You had remote controlled attacks, or what one of my colleagues, David Gartenstein-Ross, has called the virtual entrepreneur, right? These remote controlled attacks where ISIS was getting in touch with individuals and kind of through encrypted comms directing their attacks. Mm-hmm. And then the deadliest, right, which is the directed attacks, which is trained militants who are dispatched to attack a target. And I think that's what we're dealing with here with Moscow. It also shows you, you know, real deep training involved, the way that these militants shot, moved, the spacing between them, the type of operational security or OPSEC that they must have practiced to keep this attack under wraps and under the noses of Russian security services, even as they stockpiled weapons and an incendiary device to blow up the building.
Talk to us a little bit more about that. So the way they moved, the way they were using their guns, what about that tells you that they were highly trained?
Yeah, this wasn't their first rodeo. You could tell from, in many ways, there's so many parallels here. And when I was watching the footage, my brain is going in different directions. The first thing I thought of was the Moscow theater siege in 2002, right? Because I thought, wow, it's a really similar target there. And then I started thinking about the Bataclan attack, right? Because of the venue. But the attack itself, with the way that the militants were moving, reminded me maybe most of the Mumbai attack, the Lashkar-e-Taiba attack, and I think
2008.
Exactly. And so again, highly trained. These weren't a bunch of kind of inspired extremists that were sitting in a trailer imbibing IS propaganda, then decided to do something. Those attacks are often amateurish in nature. This was anything but. When all is said and done, if we're able to find out more details about this attack, I'd bet money that they were trained probably in Afghanistan, probably in ISK territory, maybe Nangarhar province. Although there is some information that some of these individuals ended up in Istanbul. And so there's clearly a link to Turkey here. And I think, something I've written about for a really long time, including in the book, is that Turkey plays a really important role globally for the Islamic State. Because unlike Afghanistan, right, which is landlocked, which is kind of cut off from, not entirely removed from globalization, but it's a much harder place. It's a very austere operating environment. Turkey is connected to global financial communication, transportation networks, right? It's a lot easier to hide in plain sight there. And a lot of my work from the time I spent at the RAND Corporation, where I was a senior political scientist for 10 years, looked at ISIS financing, right? And kind of right across the border from Iraq and Syria into Turkey, there's a lot of Islamic State money at work being laundered, being commingled, and keeping this group afloat.
And you are listening to Foreign Policy Live. Remember, you can watch these conversations live and on video on our website, foreignpolicy.com. Subscribers get to send us questions in advance, in addition to a range of other benefits, including our magazine. Sign up. Use the code FPLIVE for a discount.
Hey, it's Cameron, host of FP's weekly economics podcast, Ones and Twos. Are you intrigued by how technology like artificial intelligence and cloud computing are affecting geopolitics? Do you care about how governments are using these tools? If so, then I've got the podcast for you. Microsoft's Public Sector Future podcast features great guests like Sami Khoury, head of the Canadian Government Center for Cybersecurity, and Gulsana Mamadieva of the Ministry of Digital Transformation of Ukraine. Each episode explores the lessons of digital transformation from leaders all around the world. Head over to aka.ms/public sector future to find all the episodes, or just search for Public Sector Future wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, a lot of the references in our conversation so far, it strikes me, have been from the mid-2010s, Bataclan, the spate of attacks across Europe, European capitals. And let's just zoom out a little bit, because ISIS gained global prominence about a decade ago, and we know that it took advantage of the Syrian civil war. It captured territories there in Iraq, launched a genocide against the Yazidis. But then there's this narrative that ISIS was largely defeated. Was that not right?
I'd say in many ways it's not right. So you see all these folks now writing articles, the comeback of ISIS or the return of ISIS. My friend Aaron Zellin tweeted out a gif of LL Cool J, "Don't call it a comeback," because it's not a comeback. They have been here for years. And, again, I'll go back to the point of these franchises ebb and flow in strength, right? And we've spent a lot of time, the Counter-ISIS Coalition, which has done a great job attenuating the core group in Iraq and Syria, right? The kind of headquarters of the caliphate, Raqqa, Mosul, and elsewhere. But again, this is a global network. So if you look at terrorist activity in the Sahel, if you look at, that vast swath of territory, if you look at ISIS in Mozambique, If you look at ISIS in Afghanistan, these are areas where the group is flourishing. It's winning new recruits. It's on the march. And so, no, I don't think ISIS has ever been truly defeated. And then we could even get into the whole concept of the physical caliphate versus the ideology, the idea.
But one of the things, Colin, I'm hearing from you here is that it seems like the prominent media-covered attacks in the West might have declined a bit, but their presence and their activities across Africa and parts of South Asia have not dwindled. Is that right? So basically, our attention may have shifted, but their activities haven't changed that much.
100%. And I think that's consonant with, you know, if I'm someone that speaks in the media frequently, but at the same time, I'm also critical because I think, you know, when the problem is deemed an African one, it's far less sexy to cover, right? You know, for example, if during the apex of the Islamic State, a police officer in France was stabbed, you know, I'd get a phone call to come on CNN and talk about it. But Boko Haram could blow up, you know, a market. 80 Nigerians could be killed, and it's on page 17 of the New York Times. So I think that's a deeper issue in how the media covers terrorism, parts of the world that we expect to be unstable, right? It's not as big of a deal as if something goes sideways in Berlin, Paris, London, et cetera. And I think that's an unfortunate part of, you know, this kind of larger media ecosystem that covers terrorism. But, you know, make no mistake, the Islamic State, Greater Sahara, or the Islamic State in the Sahel. I'd throw a bunch of al-Qaeda affiliates in there too, JNIM in particular, but you know, there's large parts of West Africa that are now controlled by jihadis. And outside of my kind of niche counterterrorism circles, it doesn't seem like it's getting a lot of attention. There's also, you know, drastic humanitarian implications there too. So, you know, that's also feeding into, I think, the coverage of this issue.
Yeah, it is indeed. I see this as an editor. Let me take some questions from our subscribers, and I'll take one first from Joseph Britt, who goes, from the standpoint of an ISIS terrorist, the Moscow attack must have seemed like the equivalent of hitting the jackpot. Should we expect last week's attack to inspire more?
That's always a big concern, right? Whether it's a kind of a copycat attack or you know, the Islamic State itself trying to capitalize on the momentum. I tweeted out yesterday that sometimes these attacks have a dark energy about them. Mm-hmm. And I think in France, there was a number of schools that were closed as a result of bomb threats, if I'm not mistaken. And so, you know, when someone who sympathizes with the Islamic State and its worldview sees an attack like that, sometimes it pushes them over the edge, right? As social scientists, we're often studying human behavior. And what are those factors that get somebody who's radicalized to go over the edge and actually act in the real world, right? And there's a number of factors and variables that we can kind of isolate and talk about. But a terrorist attack itself can often be that catalyst that pushes somebody, you know, and galvanizes them to say, all right, now's my time. I'm going to do this. And that feeds into the Islamic State's propaganda. It wants to be ubiquitous, right? It wants my mom in Long Island to think that ISIS is coming for her in her backyard, right? I think, you know, and I'll go back to and give a nod to Bruce Hoffman, right? You know, probably one of the most famous terrorism scholars there is, who always brings us back and reminds us that a big part of terrorism is psychological, right? That's part of the objective, is to scare people, is to put this kind of fear in civilians. We tend to focus a lot on lethality and body counts, you know, and the kind of damage of the attack, but the psychological element shouldn't be underestimated.
Yeah, quite literally to spread terror. Here's a question from Dr. Vicky Panosian, and she asks, what are the geopolitical drivers that enable the quote-unquote reemergence of ISIS? And I know we just discussed it. Right. It hasn't necessarily reemerged. It was always there. But I think the question itself still stands because, you know, I think you wrote an FP a while ago that when it came to the war in Ukraine, for example, ISIS was celebrating the war in Ukraine because it saw it as something that drained both America and Russia. You know, whether or not America was directly involved, but in a proxy sense, it was draining these two countries that it likes to hate.
Exactly. And you know, what kind of sustains these franchise groups in various places? poor or non-existent governance, weak or ineffectual security forces, porous borders, right? Climate change, demographics, all these things that are this kind of witch's brew that we see now, particularly in parts of sub-Saharan Africa, those are all very much at play. At the end of the day, these are really hard issues. You know, sometimes you'll read an analysis or a policy document, and at the end, it'll offer you kind of policy recommendations, right? And it'll be, you know, you'll read this really great report, 10 pages in depth on the Islamic State, and then it'll say things like counter corruption, strengthen the rule of law, promote good governance. Yeah, no kidding. But how do you actually do this? Who's the implementing agency? Where are the funds for this, right? And I think there's really just some terrorism fatigue at this point. After 20 years of the global war on terrorism, people don't want to think about it. They don't want to deal with it, right? People have moved on to great power competition. You go down to the Beltway, and the conversation is about China, China, and China, and maybe sprinkle some artificial intelligence on top. But that's really where our priorities are. That's where our resources have been shifted. And I think it's left us vulnerable in this area in particular.
I want to talk about that, but let me put a pin in that thought for a minute, Colin. And just back to Ukraine for a second. President Vladimir Putin has been hinting that, you know, there could be a Ukrainian hand in these attacks. And then more explicitly, Russian state media has just been pumping out disinformation suggesting that the attackers might have been planning to head back or head to Ukraine after the fact, or that there might be a Ukrainian hand in the attacks themselves. I'm sure you could debunk that quickly. But as you do that, how much will this disinformation, could it spread, and what impacts could that have?
Well, you know, the Russians are really good at disinformation, right? They've invested a lot of resources in it. They've been doing it for a long time. The Russian fire hose of falsehood is a real thing. I've seen zero evidence of any Ukrainian involvement. I don't expect to see any evidence of Ukrainian involvement. Perhaps if the Russians were busy, you know, taking care of internal security and counterterrorism instead of looking for a boogeyman in Ukraine, 2+ years after their illegal invasion, they might have stopped the attack, which was also flagged by U.S. intelligence. So I think on some level, there's some embarrassment on the part of the Russian government, right? And they're deflecting, they're obfuscating, they're pointing the finger at anyone that they can. And, you know, when they pump out this disinformation, even if there's no data to support it, there's no evidence to support it, it still works. It still convinces people, particularly people with preconceived notions, right? It fits into their narrative. I mean, let's be honest. There's people on Fox News, Douglas McGregor, an American retired military person, carrying Russian disinformation, right? Saying the same thing. So people who are sitting at home saying, oh, maybe there's something to this, right? If they want to believe that, they're not going to go and investigate and look for the facts. It's spoon-fed to them. It's convenient. It's a nicely packaged narrative. And it now becomes fact for them. So, we're living in something of a post-truth world. And I think, you know, it's something we're grappling with. And we haven't exactly figured out how to inoculate our populations from.
No, hardly. We haven't. Something we grapple with at FP all the time as well. I want to zoom out some more now. So Al-Qaeda has come up a couple of times in this conversation so far. And we published a piece last week by Lynn O'Donnell, one of our columnists, describing how Al-Qaeda is back and thriving in Afghanistan. Talk to us a little bit about that. Are they really back? What does that mean? How much does that have to do with the Taliban?
Yeah, so even if they're only a little bit back, it's still pretty devastating, right? This was one of the biggest mistakes of the Doha deal, I think, was, you know, ceding to the Taliban. The Taliban will take care of Al-Qaeda, right? They'll make sure Al-Qaeda doesn't launch any transnational attacks. But as Lynn's article points out, Al-Qaeda is alive and well. It's growing. It's padding its pockets. And let's not forget, this is an eminently patient organization, right? I think in many ways, I've written about this at length, not only in foreign policy and foreign affairs and elsewhere, you know, they let the Islamic State take the heat when they had a falling out and kind of this battle in various parts of the world. Al-Qaeda, you know, really changed tack. They went local. They moderated in some places, right, at least compared to ISIS. And they let the brunt of Western counterterrorism focus on the Islamic State. They're biding their time. They're rebuilding their networks. And I think, you know, it's only a matter of time before Al-Qaeda kind of is back on the scene, and it's something that I'm very concerned about. I talk to colleagues on a frequent basis, particularly colleagues that spent their careers tracking and combating Al-Qaeda, right? Which seems like ancient history to most. But in other conversations I have, I've had a colleague say to me, it increasingly feels like we're approaching another September 10th. We're on the precipice of kind of totally losing track of what this group is capable of and what their intentions are. Now, I'm not suggesting that, there's going to be a 9/11 style attack on US soil. I don't think that's the case at all. But if you think about Al-Qaeda's global ambitions, US interests and assets overseas, embassies, US citizens, I am concerned that we're potentially entering another phase where we're going to have to start thinking a lot more about Al-Qaeda and what to do about them.
I'm mentioning several pieces that we've published in FP recently. We will leave it in the show notes. Colin, you've also written recently about Hamas in FP, and I was struck by the question you posed, which was whether it could transform into a more global threat. Can it?
I think so. And I've gotten, to be fair, I've gotten a lot of pushback on this from some folks who I really respect and are quite knowledgeable about terrorism and counterterrorism. And they say, it wouldn't really behoove Hamas to go global. Hamas is focused on, Gaza and next to West Bank, and they have their hands full just surviving. And I think a lot of that's true. But, one of the things that inspired me to write the article was not what's good for Hamas, it's what's good for Iran, right? Because for Hamas to go global, it's going to need Iranian assistance. And if you look at the way that Hezbollah transformed over time, right? Going from this sort of ragtag militia in the early 1980s to now this truly transnational terrorist organization that, has an impact on Lebanese politics. It's got connections to criminal rackets and, Latin America and Southeast Asia. Look, this is probably the most sophisticated non-state actor that there is today, Lebanese Hezbollah, right? With capabilities that, many states don't even have. So if Iran's intent on building Hamas into something similar, if for no other reason than to keep us chasing our tail, right, and kind of decentralizing this group and making headway in parts of the world, West Africa, Latin America, and elsewhere, then it can do so, right? We've seen them do it once. The Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, Quds Force, another highly capable organization that's training up these various actors in the axis of resistance, right? Not only Hezbollah, but Iraqi Shia militia, the Houthis in Yemen, right? All of these kind of other actors that are now at play in the region. So, could it happen? Yes, it's not a guarantee, but it's certainly something that I'm looking out for.
And I guess throughout this conversation, you're making a real distinction between the axis of resistance and, the Iranian-backed stable of groups, so Hamas, Hezbollah, Islamic Resistance, Houthis. And then on the other side, you have the more ideological groups, sectarian groups, so ISIS, ISIS-K, all of its affiliates, Al-Qaeda and others. Is that accurate to see them as that being the key difference in organizing principles?
I think in many ways, although, as you know, Iran, Shia country sponsors groups like Hamas, which is Sunni, and Palestinian Islamic Jihad, PIJ, which is also a Sunni group. So I think, we need to get beyond these kind of somewhat outdated mental models of sectarianism. Iran would only work with Shia groups. Well, that's not true. Iran's a bit more pragmatic. And so that divide is there. But I think from like a counterterror perspective, it doesn't really matter. We did a report last year at the Soufan Center, and I was interviewing a bunch of retired, very high-ranking intelligence officials, in this case in the UK. And one of the quotes that I still sticks with me from that interview was, "Nothing ever falls off the plate." And what this individual meant by that was, we're still we have these new threats that are emerging, right? We have the far right, we have the axis of resistance, we have all these other proxy warfare, state-sponsored terrorism, but the old threats haven't gone away. Again, Al-Qaeda, which we just talked about, is still there. So nothing ever falls off the plate. You have more being piled on, but you don't necessarily have more resources to deal with it. In fact, I'd argue we have fewer resources than ever to deal with what's now a metastasizing threat. And that's what leaves me with a pit in my stomach. it's hard to put your finger on it and rigorously measure these things, right? But as someone that's done this for a long time, it's a really uneasy feeling because it feels like, and then when you have things like the Moscow attack, that we're heading towards something that's big and we're kind of like sleepwalking toward it in some ways.
Yikes. Let's talk about that a little bit more. I mean, so the United States seems to have accurately warned about the possibility of a terrorist attack in Moscow. You were going there already, but what's your sense of the current state of American intelligence on terrorism?
I think, sadly, and I have nothing but the utmost respect for the men and women of the intelligence community. And it's I've spent my career attempting to support the IC, the intelligence community, or the IC, with analysis and research. But my sense is that the bench is thin when it comes to counterterrorism analysts. Look, and as a lifelong terrorism scholar, I don't want to sit here and say terrorism is an existential threat. The sky is falling. There are real threats that demand finite resources. China, artificial intelligence, and how to deal with all these other emerging technologies. But at the same time, we shouldn't be robbing Peter to pay Paul, to use an expression. So how do we kind of sustain, how do we build upon all of this expertise we've developed over the last 20 years throughout the global war on terrorism? I don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. We need to retain a lot of that expertise, because if you walk into an intelligence shop and you only have two or three analysts working on the issue, and some of them, look at Al-Qaeda as I learned about this in my history class, that's a bit worrying to me. And so that's kind of where I am now, is really wishing that we could devote more resources and kind of beef up our expertise in analytic shops. Of folks that are looking at these groups, because they haven't gone away.
And how much of this problem is a funding issue versus just an attention issue in that people are being dragged away to other priorities like great power competition?
Look, I mean, you can just go and look at the DoD's budget. We have enough money to invest in counterterrorism. It's a priority issue, right? It's kind of a perception of where the threats lie. We respond to the threats. Sometimes we're a little bit too reactive instead of being proactive. But if you look at this kind of shift to great power competition, it's almost like we just want to kind of shut the door on all things CT. So we have fewer people working the issue. We have less expertise. And I think, with a renewed push by senior leadership kind of focusing on this issue. And again, if you look at the warnings that U.S. intelligence issued to the Iranians and the Russians on these ISIS-K attacks, clearly we're still the best in the business, right, at what we do. But at the same time, I think we could do a lot more in kind of making sure that that CT expertise doesn't atrophy over time.
I was just going to ask you about that because if America is still the best in the business and it is sort of retrenching from that space, as you point out, what are the other big sources of intelligence and globally, and are they also similarly distracted with other priorities?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at our European partners, absolutely. That's a big part of the issue. There's a lot of things to be concerned about, right? And so one thing I've always written about and spoken about is kind of maintaining those relationships that we've built with our partners, right? With the Brits, with the Europeans, the Australians, all of our kind of partners around the world, and making sure that we're able to kind of leverage those, not only just when we need them, but all the time. I think, the United States has also been really good at kind of exploiting open source intelligence, or OSINT. It's a different world out there these days. You look at places like Bellingcat, which do just amazing work. I often marvel at some of this stuff. So the barrier to entry has been lowered for folks that can kind of look at these issues. But I think at the same time, given all the tools and techniques we have within the US, we should remain the standard bearer.
This has been a bracing conversation, but I think a very important one. Colin Clark, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And that was Colin Clark of the Soufan Center. He is the author of After the Caliphate. As always, if you want to know who's coming up in future episodes of FP Live, head to foreignpolicy.com. If you're not a subscriber yet, do try us out. Use the code FPLIVE for a discount. FP Live, the podcast, is produced by Rosie Julin. and Donna Shern is the executive producer of FP Live. I'm Ravi Agrawal. I'll see you next time.
Hi, I'm Annalise Riles, professor of law at Northwestern University. I'm also an anthropologist and the host of a new podcast, Everyday Ambassador, where we give you the small tools that make big change. The idea for this show has been a long time in the making. I actually remember the exact day I started thinking about it. It was March 11th, 2011. I was in Japan conducting research on the financial markets of Tokyo. All of a sudden, I heard a loud rumbling sound and the room started shaking. Everything came crashing off the shelves. I looked out the window and I could see the skyscrapers swaying so much that they looked like they would touch. And then the sirens started going off. A tsunami was on the way. These were the harbingers of one of Japan's worst ever disasters, the meltdown of the Fukushima nuclear power plant.
The Japanese government now says two reactors are in partial meltdown and four more are at risk.
The meltdown completely turned Japan on its head. I saw hundreds of stunned office workers covered in dust, walking down empty train tracks to get from the city to their homes in the suburbs. Electricity was out, internet, cell phones. Supplies flew off the shelves of stores. Geiger counters became an in-demand item, which is never a good thing. Living through a crisis of this magnitude was an inflection point for me. To prevent the next Fukushima or any of the other crises we face today, we'll have to work much more effectively across silos of expertise and national boundaries. And we'll need to harness the wisdom of everyone, from local fishers to nuclear physicists, on how the world really works and what happens when things go awry. Using this approach, I've gone on to spur countless innovations in global policy. And that's what this podcast is all about. Everyday Ambassador peels back the curtains of high-stakes leadership and gives everyone backstage access to the most powerful methods of diplomacy. In each episode, we'll break things down into deceptively simple moves that everyone can make to help build a more peaceful and sustainable world. Like giving a gift.
You want to make it tasteful. You want to make it thoughtful. You thought about the other individual. You thought about what their likes and dislikes are.
Or creating a fiction.
Taking on a fictional scenario and a role outside of the one that you occupy in your day-to-day life allows you to think through what you would like to have done differently.
Or just taking the time to have fun.
Trying to see this as more so building long-term relationships that are going to be helpful down the line when negotiations are a bit harder, as all negotiations are.
Each week, you'll hear surprising stories which reveal the moves you can make to change the status quo, to find ways to connect and move things forward. So join me and become an Everyday Ambassador, coming to you this spring on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you like to listen.